Recording in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
And welcome to the Rich Neil Show. Rich Neil here. Glad, excited you could be with me for this because, well, we're just having way too much fun. And to begin with, sorry about the little hiatus there, the time off. I had to do a lot of research for this upcoming series. And it's pretty much just me and my producer. So there's with life and working and all those other things, it takes a while, and plus you want to really do the research, especially when you're going to do a series like I'm fixing to do, which is a true crime series. You want to have all your facts and everything in a row. And you believe me, you're going to love this because we're going to have a blast talking about these subjects, because I'm always, as a historian, an amateur historian, enthusiast, studied criminal history in college. When you really get into this, it just gets the brain going. So I'm going to ask you to join me on this little adventure and kind of like, put everything to the side with all the goings-ons, with the publicly charged issues that we have, the pandemic, the politics. Let's just take a break. Let's step back and let's have a fun discussion. And let's talk about a mystery, or several mysteries, which we're going to on this True Crime series. Get also ready for the big Halloween special, premiering Halloween night. Going to love it, I guarantee. We're going to have fun on that night also. So, wow, get ready for a fun ride. And if you like this content and you want more of it, because I do have some supporters from all over the world. I was shocked, from Australia and Germany and in Europe. So, guys, I love you. And I want to be able to contact you more. Right now, if you need to get a hold of me, it's the Rich Neil Podcast. Not the Rich Neil, but Rich Neil Podcast, all one word, at gmail.com. Rich Neil Podcast at gmail.com. Now I have a Patreon page set up. So you just go to Patreon, look up The Rich Neil Show, and if you can kick in a few bucks, help support us out. We're going to get some better equipment, and we're going to be able to really get this thing rolling. When I come back, we are going on an adventure. You're going to enjoy this, I promise. We'll be right back here on The Rich Neil Show. Welcome back to The Rich Neil Show. Does crime pay? You're always taught that no. crime doesn't pay. If you can't do the time, don't do the crime. You'll always get caught. Well, for one gentleman, there is a very good possibility that it did pay. On Thanksgiving Eve, November 24th, 1971, middle-aged man, he was carrying this, like a briefcase, or they call it a black, like attaché, goes into the airport in Portland International Airport, goes up to the counter of Northwest Orient Airlines, buys a one-way ticket, okay, from Portland to Seattle-Tacoma, SeaTac, okay. He bought the ticket on flight 305, which was just a 30-minute flight over there. And he puts his name down as Dan Cooper. Now, it's 1971, okay, guys? So it's, there's no TSA, there's no show me your ID, there's none of that. It's just walk up, they give you this ticket, which is kind of like a hard piece of paper. You fill it out. The flight information and everything is already on it. You fill it out. It's like a carbon copy type of thing. And they give you your boarding pass and then they keep a copy of it. And that's pretty much how that ticket worked. So identified himself as one Dan Cooper. Now, flight 305, okay, let's kind of go back there. So when he got on the aircraft, now again, you're going out onto the runway itself and going up the ladder into the plane. There was none of these, you know, like little sky tunnels that you went through like you do today to get on the aircraft. So he boards the aircraft, and it's a 727. It's a Boeing plane. Now, there are kind of conflicts between where he sat, because again, when the flight's not full, there's no assigned seating. Just walk in, sit wherever you want. A few witnesses said it was 18C. Then somebody said it was 18E, and then another person 15D. So where exactly he sat is kind of unknown. All right, but it was toward the rear of the cabin, passenger cabin. He didn't say much. He was really, you know, kind of quiet. Like I said, mid-40s, wearing a business suit. He had a black tie, white shirt. So he kind of had this men in black type of suit going on with him. And he ordered a bourbon and soda. All right. While the flight was waiting to take off. Because back then, that's pretty much how they did that. So shortly after takeoff, excuse me, I'm drinking some coffee at the same time because, well, I like coffee. So shortly after takeoff, he kind of, the stewardess was walking down the aisle and he raised his hand. The stewardess, I want to say her name is Florence Schaffner, I think, yes. She was the flight attendant, one of the flight attendants that day. And, so Cooper hands her a note. All right. And the flight attendant, which was situated nearest to him in a jump seat, was attached to the aft stair door. Schaffner, assuming the note contained like a lonely businessman's phone number or something like that, dropped it unopened. And she just dropped it in her purse. She didn't even open it. She didn't look at it. So he hands her this note. And she thinks, oh, this dude wants to hook up with me. No, I'm not into the, you know, Mile High Club or any of this noise. So she just put the note, I guess. You know, she just threw it in her purse. And Cooper then leaned toward her and said, you better look at that note. I have a bomb. So she went ahead and, you know, dug in her purse. She got the note out. It was printed, and I believe it was like in all capital letters, done with a nice pen. Exact wording of this note is really unknown. We don't know exactly what he put on his note because he asked for it back before this was all over with. He asked for that note back. Okay, so all right. So after she read the note, he told her to sit beside him, and she did, and quietly asked, and Schaffner requested then, let me see the bomb. So Cooper opened up his briefcase, and she took a quick glimpse in, saw some red cylinders, things that you know, that looked like a bomb, attached to wires, coated in red insulation, and there was a battery also in there. So, you know, he closed it up and he says, this is what I want. He demands $200,000. And I need four parachutes. Two primary and two reserve chutes. Okay. So I also want a fuel truck standing by in Seattle to refuel the aircraft upon arrival. So the stewardess, she goes up to the pilots, and she conveys this information and these instructions to the pilots in the cockpit. And then when she returned, Cooper was wearing now some really dark sunglasses. Now, this is all unbeknownst to all the other passengers. So they're not even, they have no clue on what is going on. So the pilot, which is one William A. Scott, and he was, I believe he was in the Army Air Force during World War II. So he had some military experience. He contacted SeaTac, or the Seattle-Tacoma Airport. And he talked to their air traffic and said, look, I mean, this is what's going on. And so they contacted the local and federal authorities. Now, the 35 other passengers were given false information. They were told when they arrived in Seattle that they were going to be delayed because of a mechanical error. So Northwest Orient, you know, the president, Donald Nyrop, I don't know if I'm saying his name right. He, you know, when they talked to him, he was the one who authorized the payment. He said, yeah, you know, pay him the money, authorize him to pay the money. So give them whatever they want. Just don't blow up our airplane. And so what they did was the Air Force base, local Air Force base, said, we'll supply the parachute, but Mr. Cooper said no, he wanted civilian. So they went to some type of skydiving school to get those. And so they were the civilian, they weren't the military parachute. So then there was the other attendant, Tina Mucklow. She said that Cooper appeared familiar with the terrain. And at one point remarked, looks like Tacoma down there. And as the aircraft was, you know, flying around, He even mentioned McChord Air Force Base, which was a 20-minute drive from Seattle. Schaffner described him. He was really calm. He was kind of polite. He was well-spoken. It didn't fit the take me to Cuba type of guy or anything like that. Wasn't your typical air piracy, you know. He just didn't fit the profile of someone that would hijack a plane. All right. And now he wasn't nervous at all. But again, we don't know how much he drank before he got on the plane. And he did have a drink before they took off. And he was a heavy smoker also. So he smoked up quite a few, cigarettes. He was really nice, they said. You know, he wasn't cruel, nasty. He was even thoughtful. So he, I think he ordered like another bourbon and soda. He even, check this out, he paid for the drink and attempted to give Mucklow the change, okay, now, and offered to request meals for the flight crew during the stop when they stopped in Seattle. So anyway, they get the money together, all right, from several different banks, and it was $10,000 in unmarked $20 bills, most with serial numbers beginning with like the letter L. I think it was K or L. I think it was L. Issued, of course, by the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. Now, and most of these were the 1963 series, or 1963 to 1969 series, and made a microfilm photograph of all the. They copied all the serial numbers from the money. And again, Cooper rejected the military issue parachutes offered by McChord. He demanded civilian parachutes with manually operated rip cords. This is very important. This is very important because the military ones open up like as soon as you, you know, leave the plane. You hook up to something and it pulls the chute for you. Now, so he wanted the civilian ones. Now, why? Why would he want civilian ones and not military ones if he had military jump experience? Well, you could sabotage those parachutes to where they wouldn't open. So the military, if they wanted to pack that, they could definitely make that happen. But if they thought that he was going to have one of the stewardesses or pilot or somebody jump with him, they would mess with the parachutes. So that was the indication he was giving off. And that was a good one of the theories that may have been brought up before, but I didn't hear that until T.J. Jolly said that's what it sounded like to him. I mean, how many people were left on the plane after all the passengers were released? There you go. There was four people, four parachutes. I think there was five people, two pilots, two stewardesses, and him was five total. But anyway, he was going to take somebody with him because there were two reserve chutes and two regular chutes. All right. So at 5:24 p.m. that afternoon. Now, this flight, I believe, left around 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I'm not sure. It's something like, it was like a 30-minute flight. The flight approximately departed Portland, yes, at 2:50 p.m. All right. So he's not notified because they stayed in the air for a while. They must have, because at 5:24 is when Cooper was said his demands were met, and at 5:39 they landed at Seattle. Now, I'm getting some of this information off of Wikipedia and other from the FBI website and other sources, and so it was more than a half an hour, you know, after sunset. This is late fall. This is on the eve of Thanksgiving. So Cooper instructed the pilot to taxi the the jet to an isolated part of the runway that would be brightly lit on the apron of the runway area, and close all the window shades because, you know, you didn't want anyone taking a shot at him. So in the cabin, he didn't want any police snipers or anything like that to get a look in there. So the person that brought the parachutes and the money to the plane was another pilot. And I think he worked for Northwest Orient. I think he was like a manager, operations manager, who approached the aircraft. Anyway, so he informs the airline that he has the cash filled knapsack and the parachutes. And he sends a Mucklow stewardess the aft chair, via the aft stairs. Okay, so once the delivery was completed, he ordered all passengers, Schaffner, and the senior flight attendant to leave the plane. So they all left the plane. He let all of them go. And again, now a lot of these people didn't even know what was going on that were on the plane. So they refueled the plane, and he told, he outlined his flight plan. He told everybody it's a southeast course toward Mexico City. Okay, so at the minimum, he said, I want you to travel at the minimum airspeed possible without stalling the aircraft, which is about 100 knots. We're looking at 115 miles per hour. And we're going to go at a maximum of 10,000 foot altitude. And then he specified that the landing gear always remain in the down level, deployed level, okay, in the takeoff and landing position. So the wing flaps are to be lowered at 15 degrees and the cabin remain unpressurized. So let's think about that for a minute. He is telling you that you're going to fly this plane at the most minimum airspeed possible so you wouldn't stall out, approximately 100 knots, 115 miles per hour. And then he told them you're going to go 10,000 foot altitude. Landing gear is always going to be down. And also your wing flaps are going to be lowered at 15 degrees. So he knows, this cat knows some aviation stuff. Okay? Keep that in mind. He talks avionics. He talks shop. Now, whether or not that's something he learned on his own, did he study? Did he know somebody who knew a lot about aircraft and asked him, hey, if someone wanted to do this, you'd have to go at this speed or whatever. Did he consult somebody, or did he already know this information? Now, you want my opinion, which may not be worth much. I think this cat knew exactly what he was doing. I really do. I think he knows. And also, the cabin can't be unpressurized. Now, that's wow. So the aircraft's range, of course, was limited to only 1,000 miles under the flight configuration. So basically, he said, we would have to refuel again before going into Mexico. Right. Cooper knew that, hey, I'm not going to make it to Mexico anyway. I'm not going to make that far. But you know what? I'll entertain the pilots, and we'll have this communication going on about where to refuel. So he's going to keep these guys in guessing. And he says, I'll tell you what, let's land in Reno, Nevada. And we'll use that. With the plane's rear exit door, okay,
open and its staircase extended, he directed the pilot to take off. Northwest Home Office objected. You know, it was unsafe to take off with the staircase deployed. He countered that it was indeed safe, but would not argue the point. He would lower it once they were airborne. Again. Check it out. He knew you could lift off and fly with that staircase down. You have to know a lot about that particular aircraft to know that that is possible. So either he really knows somebody, aircraft mechanics, something, family member, because first of all, did he do this by himself? Hell no. He had to have a support group of some kind. So it just even tells me more and more he knew exactly what he was doing. But he didn't want to make a big stink out of it. He goes, you know what? Screw it. I can open it up in air. And see, and he knew that. He also knew that. So whatever. So anyway, they requested a face-to-face meeting, the FAA did, aboard the aircraft. And of course, Cooper says, nope, when the refueling process was delayed because of a vapor lock in the fuel tank. However, once it was completed, the plane was then able to take off. So they tried to do the delay tactic. They tried to sit there and say, we can't do this. Oh, there's vapor lock, which was a bunch of crap, which it wasn't. So all the passengers are off. We're talking, what, five people on board, I think. Five, maybe four left, and including him. So they go back into the air. So around 7:40 p.m., the 727 took off. With only five people on board. So yes, there was five people. Cooper, the pilot, flight attendant Mucklow, co-pilot, Radizak, and flight engineer Harold E. Anderson. Now, also, two F-106 fighter aircraft were scrambled out of McCord to follow this plane. And one was above it, and I believe one would be below it. Out of Cooper's view. So if he looked out the window, he wouldn't be able to see it. All right. A Lockheed T-33 trainer diverted from an unrelated air guard mission also shadowed the 727 before running low on fuel and having to turn back near the Oregon-California state line. And there were over five planes in total tailing this hijacked plane. So after takeoff, Cooper told Mucklow, told her to join the rest of the crew in the cockpit and remain there with the door closed. So, go in there and hang out with the pilots for a while. I want to be alone. And so she said, okay. And so she goes, she complied, of course. Mucklow observed Cooper. He was tying something around his waist at around 8 o'clock when a warning light went off. So about 8 o'clock, the pilots get this warning indicating that the staircase apparatus has been deployed. All right, so the door has been, air stair has been lowered. It's been opened in flight. The crew's offer of assistance via aircraft intercom system was refused, all right? The crew soon noticed a subjective change in air pressure indicating that that the door was, in fact, open. So now at 8:13, the tail section had a sudden upward movement, significant enough to require trimming to bring the plane back to flight level. So you're on the bottom of this staircase, and there's a lot of weight attributed because you have your parachute, you have a reserve parachute, and no telling what, 20, oh my God, 22 pounds, I guess, of money, of currency. Somewhere along in that area, 22 pounds. That's a lot of weight on there. And so when he left off the bottom of the plane, there was a lot of weight suddenly removed from the plane, and they had to do a little, you know, correction there. And that's exactly what they did. They had to level the flight. So at 10:15, so that was at around 8:13. So at 10:15, the stairs were still deployed. Scott and Razak landed the 727 at Reno Airport. And the police surrounded the jet and not yet been determined with certainty that Cooper was even on board or not. But they quickly confirmed that he was not. So, somewhere between 8:13, okay, and 10:15 in Reno, they're flying in the air from 8:13. So we're talking just barely over 2 hours. He could have jumped anywhere. Now, let me tell you something. If you're going to do a search group, you're flying at 115 miles an hour, and you really don't know exactly the flight pattern that you're on because you changed flight patterns. You're going over a different area, and you don't know exactly when this cat jumped. You have a feeling, you know, that it was fairly soon after he sent her to the cockpit that it was lock and load, get the things ready, and jump now. But there are so many. Maybe he dropped the money with the reserve chute and then jumped out by himself later to went and go to retrieve the money. We don't know. But anyway, that's here or now. There's so many different theories on what happened, but we do know for a fact that when it landed in Reno, he was not on that plane. Now, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the investigation. And again, think about all this. This mystery is going to get crazier. It's going to get a little bit crazier, and it's going to be... It's just one of those fascinating cases that it's just, once you get locked into it, you'll start watching YouTube, you'll look at videos, you'll look at all the D.B. Cooper shows and all the documentaries, and it's just a fun case to examine. So when we come back, we're going to start that investigation. We'll be right back. Rich Neal Show. And welcome back to the Rich Neal Show. We are talking, of course, about the legendary Dan Cooper, aka DB Cooper, which that name was a misprint that happened to stick. So no point in time did he claim to be D.B. Cooper. That was a journalist who made a mistake, and but the name definitely stuck. Now, investigation. The FBI, of course, you know, they climb over this plane and with the fine-tooth comb, several fingerprints. They found a black, his tie was there, and two of the four parachutes. One was open, and the lines were cut from it, which I would suspect that he used to wrap up the money. What did he put the money in? Now, he may have had some type of sack or something inside of that big briefcase. He had
But definitely he tied the money, most likely he tied the money up when he did that. And the eyewitnesses, you know, everybody was talked to and given a composite sketch was developed. The local police got involved and they started, you know, going after possible suspects. And among them considered, there was more than 800, I guess, but two dozen were eliminated from the investigation. All but two dozen, really. And there was really an Oregon man named D.B. Cooper who had a minor police record. You know, he was one of the first persons of interest in the case. He was contacted by the Portland police on the off chance that the hijacker used his real name. Right. Again, this is the information, this what I just read to you there, that came from Wikipedia right there. So, because this is information that I have verified through the FBI website. Okay, so you know, when you go FBI website there, you can learn more about the whole D.B. Cooper case. And of course, there's millions of documentaries and things on YouTube. You can look it up. But once you do, you will get sucked in. All right. So they are, this is what I don't understand. One of the last FBI agents assigned to the case, we're talking within the last, you know, 5 years, 10 years. His whole thing was, oh, he didn't survive. Now, the FBI echoed that there's no way he could have survived that jump. Because, you know, according to the last FBI agent, I think, who was assigned to the case, stated that, you know, he would go down on the stairs. He wouldn't be able to feel the wind or anything. It was minus, I don't know, 20 degrees because it was cold up there. He wouldn't have been able to survive. He probably jumped off the plane, went into a tailspin, started spinning. It was foggy, couldn't see anything, wouldn't be able to deploy a chute, and probably just fell to earth and died. So that's what the FBI would want you to think. Now, I get it. Law enforcement, especially federal, will always withhold certain key information about a case in order, if they have to revisit that case, that key information can be used to identify the person. Like, it could be something they know that he requested or asked for, or something he said that the public won't know about. That way, if they catch the real guy or they're questioning a suspect, they could say, well, if you claim to be Dan Cooper, then what did you tell so-and-so at this date at this time? And if he answers the question right, then you know pretty much that's the cat. That's the guy right there. But to say that he, I don't understand someone, and this is what I don't understand about that. That theory that the FBI give that he didn't survive the jump. So basically what you're telling me is this guy did a lot of planning. He knew exactly what flight he wanted to get on. He picked a day that wasn't the night before Thanksgiving. So everybody was already home. It's not a full flight. He did all this planning. He knew how high to fly the plane, what speed, what flaps, 15 degrees, landing gear always down. And originally the lower staircase lowered on takeoff, knew that he could do that. He knew all that. He had that knowledge. And you're gonna tell me that he put all that knowledge and all that effort into this hijacking, but didn't think about the jump? That's the most important part of this whole operation. He knew exactly what he was going to do. As soon as he said, fly at this speed, at this height, with this flaps down, because I'm going to jump. This guy had had jump experience before. And for the FBI to say, well, he probably wasn't experienced, then he would have took the plane to Mexico. He would have had a better chance of getting away with it that way. But he's not going to take $200,000 and then risk his life on dying. Now, I get it that the FBI is thinking, well, when he said go to Mexico, that if he chickened out because he wasn't an experienced jumper, then he had that backup plan. I get it. Doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Could it have? Yeah, it could be. But, nah, I'm not buying that. I'm not subscribing to your magazine, sir. Sorry. What I am subscribing to is the fact that this cat has done some parachuting before, knew exactly what he was doing. Guy had some military experience. That's all I'm saying. So, well, let's get back to this, because a month after the hijacking, the FBI distributed all the serial numbers to all the financial institutions, casinos, and everything else. Now, that's a month later. There were a couple of shady characters that ended up in Las Vegas. Okay. That paid with $20 bills. And what better place to launder money than in a casino? Do you think for 1 minute at the end of the day, the casino goes, oh, we got to go through all these bills in case one of them are the D.B. Cooper money? No, not going to happen. Banks wouldn't do it either. So that was just a courtesy. You know, the banks took the numbers and they're like, yeah, whatever. We're not going to sit here and waste our time and effort to go through every one of our transactions of $20 bills. You know, the plane didn't blow up. No one got killed. Who cares? So basically, except for the banks that gave up the money and the airline that had to pay for it, I imagine they cared deeply. So now, you know, Northwest even offered a reward of 15% of the recovered money, which was like 25,000 grand. Okay. We're talking all the way 1973, no money, 1974. None of the bills ever showed up in circulation. The airline's 180,000 claim of ransom money. All right, Minnesota Supreme Court paid the airline's money. Okay. So, this is another reason what leads to the FBI saying that he didn't survive the jump, because none of the money was ever found, ever. Well, suppose he went to Canada. Suppose he did go to Mexico. Okay, so you're not going to see that money back in circulation, maybe not ever, or it may be back now, but you'll never, you'll never find it. I always look at $20 bills anyway, just in case. Now, here's a funny thing. I think it was in 2016, the investigation was suspended. All right. Now, there was also questions about the drop zone, that they were always looking in the wrong place. Flight 305 indicated the wind direction factored into the drop zone. The calculations had been wrong, probably as much as 80 degrees, which you're talking miles and miles and miles off. So the drop zone was probably south, southeast of the original estimated, in the drainage area near the Washington River. So there was an argument over exactly where to search. There's a 60-volume case file over the 45 years of investigation that is at the FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C. here. And, of course, on the FBI website, there's a 28-part packet full of evidence gathered over the years that is completely open to the public. So if you want to check it out yourself, feel free. Like I said, that's where I got most of this information anyway. It's now there was a lot of people that gave the same description of Cooper, so they're pretty much sure that's what he looked like. Again, go to the FBI website to see that picture, what he looked at. So there you go. Now let's jump to 1980. Okay, it's Sunday, February 10th. And an 8-year-old kid by the name of Brian Ingram was, I guess he was vacationing with his family on the Columbia River. Now, why you go vacationing on the Columbia River in February? I have no idea. I don't know about that. So they're about 9 miles from Vancouver, Washington, 20 miles southwest of Ariel. For some reason, he decided to dig in a specific spot with his little bucket and shovel, and he uncovered a packs of the ransom money. He raked the sandy riverbank. He was clearing an area, I guess, to build a campfire. The bills were in bad shape, but still bundled in rubber bands. Which rubber bands will rot in a heartbeat. Underground, wet ground, they're not going to last. So this is very, very bizarre and very strange. What are the odds of you going down to a riverbank, clearing out a spot to build a fire, finding a stack of D.B. Cooper money with steel rubber bands? The money was in bad shape, but the rubber bands were still intact. Doesn't make any sense. One of these things doesn't belong to the other. It doesn't make any sense. That rubber band would have degenerated like in a heartbeat, a lot quicker than the money. The money would have lasted longer than the rubber bands. Now, they confirmed from some of the bills the serial numbers matched, and that was indeed part of that. Still, bizarre. Bizarre. What are the odds of that happening? That you, the 8-year-old kid, we're going to build a fire right here on this riverbank, sandbank. And, here's a bunch of money. And it was stacked in such a weird way that it wasn't done naturally. So it wasn't like the money landed in the water and it floated, or the current took it down and it deposited like that. Okay. That money was placed there, I'm thinking, well after the event, either to throw people off. Maybe there was somebody, maybe the real D.B. Cooper lived and was watching a documentary or combing the websites or whatever, and someone was getting a little bit too close, so they went and they buried this money. But then he would have to tip somebody off that it was there. I don't know. It's kind of weird that was the odds of that happening, that you just dig a hole and find a bunch of money in it, is just it's just incredible odds. Can it happen? Of course. Some weird things happen in this world. But I don't know. That's kind of strange. But what it does, though, is it also tells the FBI that your whole "he died during the jump" story kind of looking a little slim shady. Unless he did, someone found the body and found the money and said, "I'm keeping me some money." Because a lot of people were searching for that cat. And if a hunter or someone come across that and opened up that bag and saw all that money, probably said, he's dead. He ain't going to tell nobody. I'm going to go ahead and just take this money. And I'm going to launder this shit. And nobody's going to know anything. And I'll bury some down by the river or whatever. And that way, people will think that he was there and he buried that for some weird, bizarre reason. I don't know. That's just strange, you know, that he would find that money would be found by that kid. That was totally bizarre. And of course, in 2017, then there was some investigators that uncovered what they found an old parachute strap in the Pacific Northwest. Followed later in August 2017 with a piece of foam being part of Cooper's backpack. The FBI is not buying that. Matter of fact, they said that the parachute, the type of parachute that they found, didn't date back to that time period. There's a lot of argument there. And the FBI knew exactly everything about those parachutes before they gave them up. So, I guess they would know. Now, the reason why was, you know, with the parachutes is that they did put certain things with those parachutes that it wouldn't be non-functional, but yet you would be able to identify the parachute. So there's that. Now, the theory is he asked for four parachutes, and the FBI might have been thinking that he was going to take somebody with him, and so they wouldn't rig those parachutes for failure. Then there was another, you know, and of course, now the FBI won't say that one way or the other. That's one of those key bits of information they're going to keep to themselves. And then another theory was that later on, one of the people that packed a parachute said, yes, I put this different type of thing on here or whatever, a dummy cord, but apparently he robbed something from another parachute to put on this one. He knew about parachutes. And he fixed it and left the dummy one behind. Now, we don't know that the FBI won't be discussing too much about that. They said, now the FBI said that the inclusion of the dummy reserve parachute as one of the four obtained by the Seattle skydiving was accidental. I'm not buying that either. So, when we look at when you look at this case, you know, it's this cat apparently wanted $200,000, so there had to be a motive for that amount of money. Is that because he knew that he couldn't carry anything heavier than that? He would have to have a bigger chute that he wasn't familiar with. Could be, you never know. So when we come back, we're going to start talking about suspects and what the FBI had on the top of their list. And then, of course, every time you turn around, there are more and more suspects showing up on the website. And you have to be kind of really careful about this. It's kind of like the Jack the Ripper case, which we'll talk about in another show. But what happens is you can contaminate a case to the point to where people start relying on theory and not actual facts. Because there's so many suspects and so many theories, and it was so-and-so deathbed confession. I was D.B. Cooper, you know. Who knows? But when you get that, that is called case contamination. And after a long time, a cold case can get seriously contaminated by junior sleuths, by the internet. You have to go to the source of the investigation, the original investigation, to get the facts. You just have to. That's why I went to the FBI, to get those facts. Okay. So when we come back, we will talk about some of these suspects. We'll be right back having some good times on The Rich Neil Show. And welcome back to The Rich Neil Show as we dig deeper into the D.B. Cooper case, a perplexing case, but nonetheless an exciting case and a lot of fun to talk about. There are clubs that you can join to talk about this. There are memorials on the anniversary. People dress up like D.B. Cooper. They make a big deal out of it. So he's kind of a folk hero to a lot of people. There's been songs written about him and everything else. So when we start looking at profiling the suspects, we have to take into account that he was definitely familiar with, well, he was familiar with the area. And, I think with most of the people, he was an Air Force veteran, an Army Air Force veteran, maybe. Based on testimony, he recognized the city of Tacoma as they flew over. He even said, "Hey, that's McCord Air Force Base," and so he knew what was going on. He probably was needed some money really bad and put all this together. But I don't know. It's kind of hard to think about, when they talk about his financial situation, he was desperate, likely desperate. Key word is likely. There have been criminals who had were thrill seeking guys. So you remember Point Break, that movie, and in that movie there was a surfer bank robber type of guy. Well, there was a loosely based on a real character called Jack Murph the Surf Murphy. Good looking guy. And he was where you get the term sneak thief or cat burglar. And this dude stole some mad money, stole some art, got caught, became religious. Yeah, I think he's still alive. But it's another thing if you're interested in criminal history. Jack Murph the Surf Murphy. Check them out. This good reading there, right there. So, and then he wasn't desperate for money or had a bad financial situation, but at the same time, he was an adrenaline junkie. So when we look at D.B. Cooper, I guess he asked for $200,000. Why that much? I don't know. That's in today's money, that's quite a bit. But according to a retired chief investigator from the FBI, and I'm trying to think of his name. I think it was, he had a weird name, Himmelbach or something like that, Himmelbach. Criminals who steal that amount of money or whatever, they do it because they need it really quick or something like that. It's urgent or the crime is not worth the risk. All right. I think he was also a thrill seeker. He made the jump to prove it could be done. And, you never know. That guy could have been wearing a wetsuit underneath it, that suit that he was wearing. Could have been wearing a wetsuit to help him survive the cold weather. Or what he was wearing under his clothes. He wasn't going to be free falling that long anyway. So, a pretty good height. 10,000 feet, you know, jumping from there, you better know what you're doing. That's you just better know exactly what you're doing. So, they think that he got his name from a comic book. There was a comic book, was it German? I think German or Belgian or whatever, called Dan Cooper. And he was a fictional hero of the 1970s and he was a Royal Canadian Air Force test pilot who took part in heroic adventures and parachuting and stuff like that. So they think that he may have gotten his name from that right there. But he had knowledge about flying. We know that about the aircraft he was in. He knew all about that 727. So the way he talks about the height and altitude and height and altitude, the same thing. But from the altitude, where to put the flaps, what speed, he really knew about that. And I think he knew a lot about skydiving. You know, you'd be an idiot not to, and then do it. If you didn't know anything about skydiving and said, I'm just going to go and jump out of this plane with $200,000 because I really need the money. No, I don't buy that. Don't buy that one bit, because, you know, this jump would have had, you know, he would have had, this is where would he have landed at? Would he have somebody come pick him up? If that was the case, then he would have to require precisely timed jump. And how do you do that? You don't know what's going to go wrong during this hijacking, if you're going to be delayed or something like that, which they were. The vapor lock, remember the vapor lock on the plane? Okay, so if they were, you know, so he gets up in the air and he decides to land at Reno. Now, they didn't know if they were going to land at Reno or not. That decision was made in the air. So, did he even know where the hell he was going to jump at, or what? Because he said go to Mexico, and they said, well, we have to refuel before you get there. Now, did he know that? It was the pilots that brought that up. So, they made that decision. So how in the hell is he going to coordinate with somebody on the ground? Oh, pick me up here. This is where I'm going to land. He had no clue. So that's something else we need to think about when it comes to looking at this case. The cash discovery, several new rounds of, you know, raised more questions, of course, than it did answers on how it was deposited. And was it floated down the river? The way it was stacked up, according to the, you know, the people that found it, I don't buy that fact that it would be, you know, placed like that naturally, or, you know, from a tide or from the water or anything like that. It was put like, you know, you had a stack that was, you know, was east and west, and then north and south, east and west, north and south, money stacked on top of each other. So that's kind of a weird way. And like I said, those rubber bands definitely wouldn't survive those elements. And you got the money that was just degenerated, you know, a lot. But the rubber bands were still good. Nope. Don't buy that one bit. At all. So the free floating money theory that they had, I believe that either the people that found the money, that the gentleman whose child found it knew and directed the kid to dig there, to come across it. And so, because the odds of just going to a patch of ground and digging up money is just insane. I'm having a hard time believing that it was just one of those weird things. There's more questions than answers when you got that, and all it does is just create ungodly amounts of questions. It just makes more theories. So now people bring up statute of limitations. I'm going to give you the statute of limitations on this hijacking. Okay, and this information also comes from the you have to look up the website, not only of the FBI but of laws and stuff. In 1976, that discussion arose over impending expiration of statute of limitations. Now this is, I'm reading from Wikipedia right here. The statute of limitations on the hijacking. Most published legal analysts agreed that it would make little difference, as interpretation of the statute varies considerably from case to case and court to court, and prosecutor could argue that Cooper had forfeited immunity on any of the several valid technical grounds. The question was rendered irrelevant in November when a Portland grand jury returned an indictment in ABSENTIA. I always have problems with that word. I know what it is, but I have problems with it. That was against John Doe, aka Dan Cooper. They did a mock trial for air piracy in violation of the Hobbs Act. The indictment formally initiated prosecution that can be continued should the hijacker ever be apprehended at any time in the future. Okay, so basically they're saying the statute of limitations ran out, but yes, if something comes up because of other laws that were violated, could be brought to could be tried on those, not in particular the hijacking, but other crimes that he committed along the way, with kidnapping and all that other stuff, the federal laws that he violated. So now, between 1971 and 2016, there's 1,000 serious suspects. Literally, 1,000. There were deathbed confessions. There were junior sleuths, junior investigators coming up. And like me, everybody has fun with a mystery. So but your top-notch guys. Kenneth Christensen was one of them. He was a resident named Lyle Christensen, watched a television documentary about Cooper, became convinced that his late brother, Kenneth, was Cooper after repeated futile attempts to convince first the FBI and then the author of the film director, Nora Ephron, who hoped he would make a movie about the case. He was contacted by a private investigator in New York City. The detective Skip Porteous published book saying that Christensen was the hijacker. The following year, the episode of history series Brad Meltzer's Decoded also summarized the circumstantial evidence linking Christensen to the Cooper case. Now, I saw that show, and there is circumstantial evidence. Every one of these guys had circumstantial evidence. Every one of these. But you got to remember again, the FBI is withholding certain key information that was never released to the public in the event that a suspect comes forward and they know that if this key fits that lock, then they have their guy. But the FBI has dismissed Christensen on there. Now Christensen was in the army. He was a trained paratrooper. He made several jumps. He was stationed in Japan with the occupation forces. He left the army and joined Northwest Orient in 1954. Now he was a mechanic in the South Pacific and became a flight attendant and a pursuer based in Seattle. So he was 45 years old at the time of the hijacking. So he kind of fits the age profile. But he was shorter than what they said. He was 5'8", so he's about my height. And he was only 150 pounds. But he did smoke. He was a chain smoker. And he did have a fondness for bourbon, but which Cooper preferred bourbon and soda. So, you know, he was also left-handed. Evidence, the photo of Cooper's black tie show that the tie clip was from the left side, suggesting that the left-handed wear. Now, check this out. When you're wearing a shirt, a men's button-up shirt, that tie tack can really only, the tie clip can only go one way. It can only go one way, right to left. You know, well, if you're facing me, left to right. But, so I don't understand what they're saying that, it was placed by a left-handed person because the tie clip was facing this direction. Well, what was it clipped to then? Unless it was just a weighted tie clip. I don't know what they used back then, but who knows? So anyway, so Christensen was, so he's left-handed. Within a few months after this incident, after the hijacking, he purchased a house with cash. A few months after that, while dying of cancer in 1994, he told Lyle, "There's something you should know, but I can't tell you." And one of his friends, and Lyle said he never, his brother, and he said he never pressed his brother to explain. And they discovered gold coins in a valuable stamp collection, along with over $200,000 in bank accounts. They also found a folder of Northwest Orient news clippings about the time he was hired in the 50s and stopped just prior to the day of the hijacking. And this is Wikipedia that I'm reading this from, but I did verify it also, this information from the FBI information. There was a lot to go over on the FBI's stuff, and I poured over a lot of these documents. But so anyway, they're right. So Christensen, he did have $200,000 in his bank account. They found a folder with the clippings and everything. Yes, that was true. He continued to work part-time many years after 1971, but never clipped another news story. Big deal. Maybe he just got tired of clipping. Now, research by, Web Sleuths and later uncover proof that Christensen did not pay cash for the house he bought after the hijacking. Instead, he had a mortgage of the house. Took 17 years to pay it off. The same search would also uncover he had sold off almost 24 acres of land for $17,000 per acre in the mid-1990s, according to a large sum of money in his account at the time of his death. So that's where this guy's suspect starts to fall apart. So he didn't pay cash for his house. And he must have been getting close to being broke. So he sold his land, and that's where the money came from, the $200,000 supposedly came from. So he probably found out he had cancer and decided to leave some money behind so he wouldn't affect family members or something like that. So there you go. And he wasn't really a match by eyewitnesses. He didn't really meet the when you look at that, the picture, he kind of looked like the picture of the FBI wanted sketch, but at the same time, the people that were on the plane and the pilot and everybody else did not identify him. Which leads us to another guy, Jack Caulfield. Okay, this guy was a con man. He was a convict. He was a chauffeur. And he was also a chauffeur and confidant of Abraham Lincoln's last disputed descendant, great-grandson Robert Todd Lincoln Beckwith, in 1972, began claiming he was Cooper, and attempted through an intermediary, former cellmate,
to tell his story to a Hollywood production company, landed near Mount Hood, about 50 miles, injuring himself, losing the ransom money in the process. Yeah, so they don't really buy this guy's story either. The FBI reviewed and concluded that it was, you know, some of the details didn't match. They kept him on the burner, you know, but really didn't pay much attention to him at all. He had pretty much discredited that one. So Jack Caulfield, way at the bottom of the list, in my opinion. Now, Lynn Doyle Cooper, a leather worker, Korean War veteran, proposed as a suspect in July of 2011 by his niece, Maria Cooper. When she was 8 years old, she required her uncle planning something very mischievous, and that he used, you know, he had extensive walkie-talkies at his grandmother's house, and they tested certain things, and that she was in the living room playing and overheard certain talking things, and said that Lyle, or he died in 1999, but she claims that he was there in August 2011, published an alternative witness sketch, and based on the description by Flight 305 witness Robert Gregory, depicting horn-rimmed sunglasses, a russet-colored suit jacket and wide lapel, and marshaled hair. Okay, the article notes that L.D. Cooper had wavy hair that looked Marcel, as did another suspect, Wayne Weber. So the FBI announced that no fingerprints had been found on the guitar strap made by L.D. Cooper. They were trying to do that. And then 1 week later, they added that his DNA did not match partial DNA profile obtained by his tie. So they did lift some DNA from his tie. Okay, so they have a partial DNA. And they have fingerprints. So, you know, it's going to be fairly easy to identify the guy when he does come forward. They just get his fingerprints, and hopefully the fingerprints where he was sitting. Well, maybe match one of those fingerprints on the plane. At least he was on the plane, if you say that. So, once again, now there's no certainty that the hijacker was the source of organic material obtained from the tie. So it could have been contaminated, you know, so they have a partial DNA, but I wouldn't really take much stock in it. Barbara Dayton. All right. He was a recreational pilot at the University of Washington, and he was also a librarian. A librarian who was born Robert Dayton. So he was a recreational pilot and University of Washington librarian. He served in the U.S. Merchant Marines and in the Army during World War II. He worked with explosives in a construction industry, professional airline career, but could not obtain a commercial pilot's license. Claimed to have staged, he claimed to have staged the hijacking 2 years later as a man to get back at the airline and the FAA, who insurmountable rules and conditions prevented him from becoming a pilot. The ransom money was hidden in a cistern near Woodburn, a suburban of South Portland, but eventually recanted the story after learning the hijacking charges would still be brought. The FBI never commented publicly, and Dayton died in 2002. So, if you ever come across a cistern, okay, in that area, you know, near Woodburn, make sure you take a look in there. Don't fall in. Don't get stuck down there. But you never know. If you find some money, then we, You may even solve that case right there. William Gossett. Let's check this cat out. Part of the Marine Corps, Army Air Force veteran, saw action in Korea, Vietnam. He was obsessed with the hijacking. He had amassed volumes collection of Cooper related news articles. This guy was just, he was a Cooper geek. In 1988, changed his name to Wolfgang and became a priest, which Cook and others interpreted as an effort to disguising his identity. Circumstantial evidence includes testimony that Cook claims he had obtained from William Mitchell, a passenger on the aircraft, mysterious physical detail which he did not divulge. Common to the hijacker, Gossett. Cook also claimed to have found possible links to Gossett in each of the four letters signed by D.B. Cooper and mailed three newspapers within days of the hijacking, although there is no evidence that the hijacker created or mailed any of the letters. So there again, you have the letter writing, which a lot of criminals have done. Jack the Ripper wrote letters to mock the police. The Zodiac did cryptid letters with ciphers and mocked the police at the same time. And then, so now you had this one guy, and then D.B. Cooper was apparently did the same thing, but the FBI doesn't believe it because it doesn't match the handwriting on the ticket that he filled out at the airline. So yeah, they're saying that even though a lot of people would say there's not enough information on the airline ticket to gather a profile of how he would write, but. Who knows? Never know. There's not one link to the Cooper case. Special Agent Carr, other than statements, you know, Gossett made to someone. So not a real heavy hitter either. And then Robert Richard Lepsey, 33-year-old grocery store manager, married from Grayling, Michigan. Disappeared October 1969. The vehicle was found 3 days later at a local airport. And a man matching Lepsey's description was reported seen boarding a flight to Mexico. Authorities concluded that Lepsey had left voluntarily and closed their investigation. 2 years after the Cooper hijacking, family members noted that Lepsey's physical features resembled those in the composite drawings and asserted that Cooper's clothing was described as very similar to his grocery store uniform. Lepsey was declared legally dead in 1976. One of his daughters submitted a DNA sample of the FBI in 2011, unknown results. Although Lepsey was proposed as Cooper's suspect in 2014 book, there's no record of him that the FBI basically said, no, it wasn't him. Then there's John List, there's Ted Mayfield, Richard Floyd McCoy Jr., and Robert Rackstraw's another strong guy. So, Walter Recca, William J. Smith, Dwayne Rever. So, there's several of these cats, and you can go and look these up and read about them. And several other descriptions. It would take me forever to go through each one of these guys. And believe me, I read over so many of these documents about this case that every one of these suspects are all circumstantial. The FBI has pretty much always had a reason to dismiss these guys. Now your book investigators, you know, a lot of people don't want this mystery to be solved. It could already been solved. You never know, one of them books could have been right, one of them guys could have been him. But other sleuths, other detectives, they don't want you to figure it out. Because believe it or not, it's a money-making industry. You can make tons, you know, tons of money off of this. You just find someone who fits the description, was in the area at the time, claim that he's a suspect, make all this circumstantial evidence up, write a book, go out and tour with the book and do your little news shows because it's going to make money. It's a money-making business. There's tons of money still being made off of Jack the Ripper. That happened in 1888.
the Zodiac in the 60s. No one discovered who he is. There's a ton of money being made off of him.
So there's nothing different here. That so is D.B. Cooper. So, you know,
people are going to, every time you write a book, every time you come up with a suspect, it's going to get shot down pretty quick because they don't want you to figure it out. They want to be the ones that figure it out. No, my suspect is the real one.
So that's what they want to do. So I encourage you, if you're interested in this type of, in this story, get on Wikipedia, get on the website. There is a huge cult of D.B. Cooper sleuths and people that go out there and take a look at it. But he got away. That we do know.
He exited that plane. He exited that plane and then disappeared. What happened to D.B. Cooper? Is anyone's guess, but man, it's a lot of fun speculating about it. If you enjoyed this show, let me know you care. You can send me an email, richneilshow@gmail.com, richneilshow, all one word, @gmail.com. And if you really want to let me know you care, go to Patreon. Kick in a few bucks, we can get some better equipment, and we can keep rolling with this content. And I hope you enjoyed this story as much as I enjoyed telling it. It's a lot of fun. Thank you for listening to The Rich Neil Show, and we will see you soon. Good day.